Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, is known for her important work as a longtime journalist and author of the seminal best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, on not getting by in America. Her latest book is a sharp departure from her social justice work. It's called Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. Barbara Ehrenreich, a proud atheist who was educated as a scientist, calls her book a philosophical memoir or even a metaphysical thriller. In a recent New York Times op-ed, she writes, quote, "Something happened when I was 17 that shook my safely rationalist worldview and left me with a lifelong puzzle. Years later, I learned that this sort of event is usually called a mystical experience," end quote. In Living with a Wild God, Barbara recounts her quest, beginning in childhood, to find the truth about the universe. What's really going on, and why are we here? How does a nonbeliever search for the truth about everything? Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of 14 books, including Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch, and she joins me here in studio. Hi, Barbara. Nice to see you.
Good to see you again, too, Rose.
Thanks for coming in. So, this is a huge departure from all of your work. Usually, we're talking about how the poor, how hard it is to be poor, or social justice issues. But this does raise a lot of interesting questions that a lot of people are afraid to touch, as you found out. Why did you decide to explore these questions and write a book about the search for everything?
Well, I think it all started when I had no idea, before I had any idea of writing a book about anything, when I was about 12. And I decided that this was going to be my mission in life, to find out the answers to all the big questions. And I thought it would take, you know, if I really concentrated, a couple of months. I didn't know that others had been batting their heads against this for thousands of years. So that's where it all began. But the decision to write something and talk about these things to other people is fairly recent. This is not easy. I didn't, you know, the strange mental adventures that went on when I was a teenager, I never spoke of them to anybody. And then suddenly here I am. I'm on a book tour. I'm talking to complete strangers.
And you reveal a lot about your life. I mean, you talk a lot about your childhood, your relationship with your mom and dad, your inner thoughts. What was that process like for you?
Well, you see, I had a primary source, a historical source, which was the journal that I kept when I was a teenager. It's not a day-by-day journal, but it's where I wrote down what I was learning, in this quest to find the answers to all the big questions. So that is what I have to go on. And when I finally read through that in 2005, that recently, I felt, I wanted to do something. I felt like I wanted to annotate the journal entries for my children so that they would have this as part of the family history.
What was it like to find the journal and to reread what you wrote as a young girl to your older self?
Well, it's an interesting relationship you have with your teenage self like this. There was one particular entry that absolutely challenged me. I was 16, and see, I was writing the journal for my future self, which I thought would be like 6 months in the future. I didn't know it'd be like decades. And I came across a place where I say, to my future self, please read this with compassion. And I'd like to know what you've found out in the meantime. How have you kind of advanced the quest? And whoa, you know, that's something to hit you as you're entering, you're going beyond middle age, and there's this younger you saying, well, what have you done? What have you accomplished?
I was telling some friends about your journal, and a lot of people said, well, I wish I would have done that as a young girl, to write a journal for my older self, to ask her questions.
Yeah, I think it's
so fantastic.
I think it's it's a good thing to do. I think I wish more people would do it. I wish more people would also talk about those experiences that seem to them most unshareable.
Well, and over the course of writing this book, and I understand that as you wrote it, you always stuck it at the bottom of the pile, right, to get other stories done, yes, and to work on other projects. Mm-hmm. But over the course of writing it, you found that a lot of people have had what we refer to as mystical experiences, but they're afraid to talk about them.
Well, I first found, I mean, I'd say as a general statement, this is very, it's not uncommon to have an intense mystical experience. There was a Pew Center survey a few years ago that found like 49% of Americans say they've had something like this. Now, I don't know what that means, yeah, because there are people who describe a great meal as a religious experience. I just don't know. But it's not uncommon, and we have records, for example, of various like Christian mystics who were, I emphasize Christians just because they tended to write a lot about their feelings and what they experienced. So there's a tradition, religious traditions, which I, you know, sort of didn't pay attention to because they seemed so religious, and also non-believers, like Virginia Woolf, who was a very staunch rationalist and secularist, but she had these unaccountable, uncanny experiences.
And we'll talk about your experience in a minute, but it seems like the other goal of your book is to sort of take back the word religion in a way, or to get us to rethink our own opinions of religion. And before the show, we were talking about how religion in the media is very skewed. You have the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons are always interviewed on religion, and that's for the most part it. I mean, you don't really hear from Unitarians on the radio or the United Church of Christ, where they recite Native American poetry. I mean, it's pretty skewed when you look at religion in the national media.
Well, it's skewed in a more profound sense, too, that most of the dominant religions in the world today are monotheistic religions. What, you know, just drove out the others. Perhaps most on the grandest scale, when Western colonizers, you know, went throughout, conquered the world, so much of the world, in the 18th and 19th century, bringing with them Christian missionaries. Similarly, the Arabs in Africa squelched indigenous religions. I'm not even sure that religion is the right word for every way in which people came together or went separately somehow to encounter the transcendent and then reinterpret it to their people.
So why don't you read from your book and give us a little context about when you had this, what people call a metaphysical experience.
Okay, well, there's a lot of action in the book because
I remembered a lot about your childhood.
Well, I was trying to frame the journal entries and bring back things, and I had to do some research, and I had to track down some people and talk to some distant relatives and so on. This experience occurred when I was 17. I had gone with my younger brother and a high school friend on a severely poorly planned skiing trip to Mammoth. You know where that is?
Yes.
It's in California,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And we lived in L.A. at the time. So we had a magnificent day of skiing. And then for reasons that I had to patch together, I mean, I had patched together to write the book, but for reasons I didn't know at the time, we ended up spending the night in the car in the little town of Lone Pine, California. So here I was, exhausted, no doubt hypoglycemic. I mean, all the conditions for a Plains Indian vision quest really were being met, but not that I was thinking of that. And then I get out of the car in Lone Pine very quietly, leaving my companions sleeping, and start walking out in the street before dawn. Now I'm reading from the book. In the next few minutes on that empty street, I found whatever I had been looking for since the articulation of my quest, or perhaps, given my mental passivity at the moment, whatever had been looking for me. Here we leave the jurisdiction of language, where nothing is left but the vague gurgles of surrender expressed in words like ineffable and transcendent. For most of the intervening years, my general thought has been, if there are no words for it, then don't say anything about it. Otherwise, you risk slopping into, quote, spirituality, which is, in addition to being a crime against reason, of no more interest to other people than your dreams. But there is one image handed down over the centuries that seems to apply, and that is the image of fire, as in the burning bush. At some point in my pre-dawn walk, not at the top of the hill, at the top of a hill, or at the exact moment of sunrise, but in its own good time, the world flamed into life. How else to describe it? There were no visions, no prophetic voices, or visits by totemic animals. Just this blazing everywhere. Something poured into me, and I poured out into it. This was not the passive beatific merger with the all, as promised by the Eastern mystics. It was a furious encounter with a living substance that was coming through at me through all things at once. And then I'll just say a few words about the sentence here about the experience, sort of more emotionally. Ecstasy would be the word for this, but only if you are willing to acknowledge that ecstasy does not occupy the same spectrum as happiness or euphoria, that it participates in the anguish of loss and can resemble an outbreak of violence. So it took me, shall we say, most of my life to be able to write those words. Hmm. And I read them now because I just can't sort of reframe them so easily.
That's Barbara Ehrenreich reading from her new book, Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. When you were on Fresh Air, you told Terry Gross that people have these unaccountable mystic experiences, and either they say nothing or they label it as an experience with God and they get on with their lives. Mm-hmm. But you say, wait a minute, let's talk about it and let's figure out why this happened and what's going on here. So what has that process been like for you to kind of revisit it and then write about
it? Well, I think it was a sort of a big decision that I was making very slowly, incrementally over the years, that not to back off from it. See, my initial response when I was 17 was to say, okay, there are two possibilities. One, this was some kind of encounter, which a religious person would probably say, oh, that must be God. But I saw no godlike imagery or anything like that. Or I was insane. I had a mental breakdown. Those were my choices. I decided to go with the insanity defense for many years and just say, well, all right, I got something, you know, peculiar neural breakdown went on, and I'm moving on and I'm doing other things in the world. But then I decided against that. And partly because I do have a very scientific mind, I think you don't ignore anomalous data. You don't throw out that data point that doesn't fit in with your preconceived theory. You look into that. So I'm saying, hey, let's not leave this stuff to the religious people, the theists, to the spiritual people who are often hard for me to connect with. Let's try to think rationally about what goes on. What are the experiences of other people? What can we learn from this about the universe?
So what have you learned?
Do you think I'm just going to tell you the whole secret? You have to read the book.
I mean, you've done so much research for this, but you know, thinking back about it today, have you changed your opinions about anything? Have you changed the way your belief system works? I mean, has there been
I don't
a major
have a belief
shift?
System, Rose.
Okay. Has there been a major shift
no
or anything?
No beliefs.
No beliefs.
That's my principle.
Okay.
Don't believe. Look for evidence. I have some respect, in fact, for religions which don't ask for faith or belief, but instead invite you to actually experience their deities, your spirits, through ecstatic ritual. I may convert. Who knows, you know?
Barbara Ehrenreich is out with a new book, Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. And she started the book after rediscovering a journal she kept as a teenager, which recounts an event she had, which she just described. And in the book, in her journal, she asks a lot of questions. What's the point of our brief existence? Why are we here? And we'd love to hear from you. If you've ever had one of these experiences, what did you do with it? Did you talk about it? Did you think about it? And how do you tackle these questions? What is the point of our brief existence? Why are we here? Of course, they come up when someone passes. My grandmother passed a few weeks ago, and these questions came up for me, first time I lost anyone close to me. So if these questions come up for you, how do you tackle them if you consider yourself an atheist or, as Barbara just said, not a believer, but you have evidence for your life and the questions that you pursue? What are your thoughts on this? And then if you have a question for Barbara Ehrenreich about her journey, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. When you look at the question, what is the point of our brief existence? As someone who's been so deeply involved in social justice issues, how do you look at that question?
Well, I think that's another issue for me. I feel called upon, responsible for, et cetera, doing something about suffering in the world. And that does not come from any mystic experience. That in fact, I would say in my case, it's somewhat rooted in the atheism that I was brought up with, that there's no deity that is going to step in and help the beggar on the street. You have to do it. There's nobody else. You know, there is no divine plan that is going to make everything turn out all right, no matter how many people now are homeless or hungry or being killed somewhere in the world. It's our responsibility. So that's something that's an overriding thing that about my sense of morality that I would trace to not being a believer.
Well, and a lot of that came from your childhood because you were raised as a fairly hardcore atheist.
Oh yes.
Talk a little bit about that. Talk about your parents and
These were originally blue collar people. My father was originally a copper miner in Butte, Montana. As were most of the men in my family, unless they were railroad workers. And the story goes about our particular family that a great-great-grandmother in Montana, this would be in about the 1880s, is the one who broke with the Catholic Church. This is a Irish-American woman, Mamie McLaughlin was her name, and when her father lay dying, she sent for a priest to come and administer last rites. She got back a message saying the priest would only come for $25, which was an unthinkable sum. Mm. A couple of years later, she herself lay dying in childbirth, and the priest just showed up and began to administer last rites and put a crucifix on her chest. And the story that I was told as a child was that with her last ounce of strength, she threw that crucifix across the room. Hmm. So you can see that the atheism was entwined with some kind of class sense, that we did not trust or like doctors, lawyers, bosses, or priests. that was the populist thinking.
You talk a little bit about how atheism shaped your views about the poor and the homeless. How else did they shape your views about the work you do today?
Atheism?
Atheism. How else did it, I should say?
I just think it leaves us with this huge responsibility. Mm-hmm. You can't shrug anything off and say, oh, a benevolent deity is going to take care of that, or it's all part of his plan. I don't like his plan if it includes so much suffering. So if I'm a moral person and I acknowledge the existence of this monotheistic God, I have to combat him. I have to go up against him.
Barbara Ehrenreich is author of Living with a Wild God, and we have a number of callers on the line. Let's hear from Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Cool. First, this book sounds awesome. I was really glad to be listening to the radio this morning. Definitely going to check it out. I had an experience a few years ago. I was studying a lot of Eastern religions and philosophy, and grew up kind of Christian, socially Christian, I would say. And I had an experience that has been deemed now a psychiatric break. I meditated myself. I had seen a vision of when I was on a hallucinatory substance, we'll say. And I figured that to be kind of the ultimate good. I saw a star being born. And so then later on, totally clean and sober, I meditated myself into what I thought would be a dark place, the lowest of lows, thinking in my quest for enlightenment, okay, if I find the peak and I find the bottom, then I'll know it all. And then after that, I wasn't getting sleep, kind of was going through different stages of time and actual visual hallucinations of seeing different things going on and thinking I had kind of the control of the world in my hands. And so my friend felt a little worried about me, brought me to the hospital. And then the biggest thing that kind of weirded me out about it was this, once it got put into hospitalization and doctors started looking at me, that's when I thought I had done something wrong. And it was this psychiatric evaluation and label that got put on it that started freaking me out more, and I would relapse. So I was wondering how you, because from a scientific mind, it seems that you're having, how did you deal with kind of labeling it as going crazy, going insane, that your mystical experience, and then kind of
well, fortunately, I cleverly stayed away from doctors or anybody. Nobody noticed anything strange about me, which just says something about my family right there. But I was... I had the sense that there would be trouble. I knew what mental hospitals were for. Yeah. So this is a big reason for keeping it entirely to myself.
How have family members responded? Your children first, since you wrote this book really for them.
Yes, positively.
Yeah.
Thank the goddess. And got a little grief from my sister because the word God is in the title. As atheists, we're not... She felt that was something of a compromise.
Why did you decide to have God in the title?
Well, there's always something a little arbitrary about title selection.
Yeah.
But
right.
It sounds... It's a little easier to say than living with a wild other possibly conscious presence that occasionally manifests itself in the universe? No.
That might go well here. And how do you feel just before we go to break? I mean, we have full lines now. You've been on other radio shows taking calls from people who've had similar experiences asking you now questions about maybe what this means or what to do with this.
Well, I think this is exactly what I wanted. I wanted people to start talking. I don't want people to feel that they're crazy, to feel that they're isolated. You know, let's bring this into the, shall we say, light of reason.
Barbara Ehrenreich is author of the new book, Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. She grew up as an atheist, and she's trained as a scientist. And in this book, she looks back on her life, her childhood, a mystical experience she had at a young age, and found a journal not too long ago that she wrote in her teen years. I really love that she found this. And her young self asks her older self, so what have you been doing, and what is the point of our existence? And we'd love to hear from you. We'll take more of your calls right after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Lots of ways to join in today's conversation. On the phone, it's 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. If you'd rather write, then give us a jingle. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, a look at the British police's plea to Muslim women in the UK to persuade their relatives not to go off to fight in Syria. The campaign for women to intervene follows a string of deaths of UK men who joined the civil war against President Assad's regime. A similar initiative was launched this week in France. That's what's coming up at 11 on the BBC's World Have Your Say here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be joined by filmmakers Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl, directors of the new documentary Citizen Coke, a documentary about money, power, and democracy. The film looks at how Citizens United drastically changed the country's elections and how they're fought and paid for. This film was actually financed through Kickstarter after the independent television service withdrew funding because they didn't want the word Coke in the title. So that's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, a well-known journalist and author best known for her book, Nickel and Dimed, on not getting by in America. Her latest book is a sharp departure from her social justice work. It's called Living with a Wild God, a non-believer's search for the truth about everything. And in the book, she recounts her quest, beginning in childhood, to find the truth about the universe. What is really going on, and why are we here? And this started when she found a journal she wrote as a teen. And in July 1958, the younger Barbara wrote, quote, "I write this from a sense of duty, a feeling of obligation to my future self, whom I implore to read with compassion. What will I be? The person who later reads this. Myself, the same as ever. What have you learned since you wrote this?" End quote. So we'd love to hear from you. How do you tackle these questions? Whether you consider yourself religious or you're an atheist, how do you tackle these questions? What's really going on? Why are we here? What is the point of our brief existence? And if you've ever had a mystical experience, if you'd like to talk about it, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And if you have a question for Barbara about her journey writing this book, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Andrew in San Francisco. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Hey, I just want to say, first off, thank you. I really appreciate this the book that you guys, that you wrote. I personally grew up in a really Christian family and was not religious from kind of a young age, and I had many, many kind of quote-unquote mountaintop experiences at camps and at retreats where, you know, that have these fleeting, very religious kind of ecstatic moments and then come back to real life and just sort of not have anything, even mildly, you know, that felt mildly like a relationship to God or anything like that. And I guess I just want to say thanks. And then my question is more to say, how do you feel that, why do you think that it is that people who are really religious have a hard time accepting the idea that you can have purpose without religion and without some sort of overarching God? And my family really struggles with the fact that I kind of have a selfless mindset, desire to do good for the world, and they question me almost every week on why I would feel that way if I don't have God. So why do you think it is that people really struggle with that?
Well, everything in our culture is framed so theistically. I think there's a tendency to say, well, there's this mundane world we live in where we kind of make calculations for our advantage and, you know, do our jobs and everything. And then everything else goes in a lump called spirituality and religion. And maybe we should throw psychedelic drugs in there too. I don't know. Just, you know, it's all in one big lump. Since I was not raised theistically, it's just not a factor. It is just was not a way of seeing things. And as I was just explaining, you could have very strong moral sense that accompanies the idea that there is not a good God taking care of us, that we've got to do the work.
What are your thoughts, and how would you describe the way religion has, or the way religion plays such a huge role in our society and politics today? Do you think it's
politically?
I mean, because it comes up on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Politicians talk about it on a regular basis.
No, I know. And I also know as an atheist that I pretty much can't run for office. Hmm. You know, that they're definitely, I've experienced as a kid especially a certain amount of persecution for, quote, not believing in God. You know, that was sort of required. We all had to say the Lord's Prayer every morning in school and so on. So I'm think that's an important battle. But we've had this great generation of, quote, new atheists, Hitchens, Dawkins, and others, who have, I think, taken all on. I am more interested in saying, okay, now let's move on. That subject, I think, is kind of exhausted. If you're talking about a benevolent monotheistic God, sorry, doesn't work out. So now what do we make of things, including those mystical things that have always been claimed by religion?
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Chris. Let's go next to Caitlin in – I'm sorry, Andrew. Let's go next to Caitlin in Santa Cruz. Hi, Caitlin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really interested in the last statement that you made, which is going beyond that monotheistic sort of structure into something that's more inclusive of a general human experience so that we can get beyond the little sectarian things. And I worked in mental health for about 20 years, and one thing I noticed in working with clients is that some people were much more successful at the experiences that they were having than others. And that people who didn't have a new structure to put their experiences into generally kind of fell into chaos and wound up being labeled as mentally ill. And whereas people who had more information, more structure, more understanding and acceptance of the experience were more successful at incorporating it into a higher level of consciousness. So I'm really interested in that kind of, like, how do you get together in your community with people who are supportive of it and can take you and hold you kind of like a mentoring process so that you can achieve that and share the experience and incorporate it into your community reality?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't know, but you just suggested whole lines of possible thinking to me. You know, one way to look at this, which may sound strange, but is almost in a public health way, if large numbers of people do have such experiences, and they can be shattering, such as mine was, both ecstatic and shattering, we should really be trying to find out what's going on. I mean, it was very hard for me in the months that followed this. I both wanted to re-experience it, and I also thought my life was over. So, there was nobody to talk to, I didn't even find anything in books that was very much help, ever, at that time. So I like the way you're thinking, Caitlin.
And you've never been into psychedelics, right?
No.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to read that. I thought maybe you would have experimented when you were younger.
I will admit this is some research I have yet to do.
Yeah. But what do you think about people who've done psychedelics who have these experiences?
Well, I think from what I can tell is that their experiences sound different. From mine, there's a big element of hallucination, often, and just an intensification of the beauty of the world, which does make sense to me, but it doesn't seem the same. And one reason I didn't try LSD when it was being handed out so readily at one point was that I had this experience, and I just didn't want to mess with that kind of thing. It's not recreational.
Well, thank you for calling. We've got an email from a listener who says, Miss Ehrenreich's description of her mystical ecstatic experience matches some of my own as I've practiced on the Buddhist path. What's interesting is that I came across them as part of a systematic process and am now able to recall them as part of my meditation work. Ecstasy just through watching my breath? Thanks, I'll have some. This manifestation is called pity in the Pali language of the early Buddhist sutras and is a factor leading to great concentration liberation and sometimes even enlightenment, a shame that her devout atheism may have prevented her from investigating further.
Oh, well, I don't think of Buddhism as a theistic religion. There is no deity at the center of it. You're not asked to believe in something or worship something. So I think of it as something almost secular in its more, you know, mystical ways of practice. I don't know that much about it, but I welcome this insight.
Well, thanks for the email. Let's go back to calls. Let's hear from Vrinda in Berkeley. Hi, Vrinda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose, and hi, Barbara. Both of you are heroes of mine.
Oh,
thank you.
And this show is one of the most exciting things that's happened to me in a long time. Barbara, I was wondering if you've read Jill Bolte Taylor's account of her stroke.
I think I did, yes. A stroke of insight?
Yeah.
I did read it.
Yeah, well, you know, I've spent my life wondering about these things, and I've come to the conclusion that belief is a bad, you know, kind of a dead end. I struggled to try to believe stuff, and that was, I don't know, when I was able to let go of that and decide that it's okay to not know, it was a really, it was a great thing for me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I refuse to believe.
Yeah.
I will honor other, you know, if you tell me that you're a believer, I'm not, you know, going to despise you for that. But just don't ask me to believe in the same thing. However, I have one difference from you. I'm not satisfied with not knowing.
Yeah, I know.
I have to know.
Yeah, I admire that. I think it's great to keep trying to know.
Yeah.
You know, and accumulating evidence and testing evidence, I think that's great. And one more thing I wanted to say was, even though I don't believe things anymore, I have a feeling that if there is a God, the only thing that he or she demands of us is compassion.
That would be nice. I'm not so sure, though. I don't think our morality has anything to do with such a possible entity. You know, I throw out at the end of my book the conjecture based on a lot of things that based, in fact, on quite a critique of science, actually, that there are other conscious entities in the universe that are normally invisible to us, and but with which we can have some kind of contact. They are not moral beings. Our human morality is rooted in our evolution as social animals. I don't think it's something universal. And when I talk about other beings, I come to that very carefully, reminding us that there have been many occasions in the past when science has, the last couple of decades, denied the awareness and consciousness and feelings of non-human animals. You know, they were just things, objects. We just killed them. Well, I won't even tell you how many mice I killed in the course of my research. I fear the mouse god, I guess. But that there was an enormous failure to, until, you know, people kind of connected with common sense. Yes, we know animals have feelings and have unique personalities. So that's just changed. There's a tendency, since at least Descartes, to see the world as dead. And that leads to enormous paradoxes. How can there only be human mind? Oh, well, there must be a God then. But I am proposing that the world is far from dead.
I'm glad you brought this up, because even the scientific community is now writing about fish having feelings.
And plants. No kidding. No. I mean, that's one frontier Oliver Sacks had an article in one of the most recent New York Review of Books about the investigation. Now, plants don't have nervous systems.
Right.
But there is evidence of some sort of learning and even, peculiarly enough, evidence of some kind of altruism among plants.
We're speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich about her new book, Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. In the book, she recounts her quest beginning in childhood to find the truth about the universe and to answer these questions and explore these questions. What's really going on? Why are we here? And what is the point of our brief existence? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for calling in, Vrinda. Let's go next to James in Oakland. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rose and Barbara. Much respect. Thanks for the great work that you guys do. Great conversation. I'm an artist and musician, and Barbara, your kind of ecstatic experience reminds me of a lot of experiences that I've had at live music shows and also creating my own music and playing it. And I feel like my fine art pursuit, too, is a way of kind of translating those things that we know are there but can't see that I've kind of experienced, say, in the Redwoods around where I grew up in the West Bay. And for me, the pursuit of art and music is a way to put meaning into my life through a kind of, you know, creation. So, yeah, I just wanted to interject that into the conversation and see what your guys' thoughts are.
Yeah, I love that, James. I totally agree with you. In fact, I would say when in recent years when I have had these sorts of experiences, fortunately on a much milder scale than I did as a teenager, it seems like an aesthetic experience in a sense. It is being overcome by the strange beauty of the world. Mm. And I think that links this to artistic creativity, although not that I'm claiming any for myself, but in your case. And it's something we do approach through music and art.
And as you write about in your book, I mean, you have great love for the outdoors, and a lot of people have these experiences when they're in nature.
Yes, there are no recorded mystical experiences in cubicles. At least I don't think so.
All right, well, thank you for calling, James. Let's go next to Mark in Sunnyvale. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Very quickly, I was an atheist for 25 years until a series of mystical experiences about 22 years ago that seemed like the proverbial unseen hand trying to beat it into my head. No matter how rational you are, there's something here that you need to know that you can't rationally understand. And it started me on a long, long quest of trying spiritual with the rational. And the conclusion I reached about what we call God, and I use the term very loosely like Barbara does, I have had an experience of spiritual beings, for lack of a better term, that communicate with us on some level. And I think the reason God so often fails religions and people ask questions like, how could the Holocaust happen if there's a loving and benevolent God? The conclusion I reached was that the mistake religions make, going back to the concept that all of them are based on, that the Earth is the center of the universe and that as its dominant species, we must therefore be the purpose of creation. That's the most errant thought in the history of humanity. And I think the mistake religions make is the conception that God is omnipotent and the creator of the universe. I don't know where the spiritual realm comes from, but the only sense I can make of it is that it's something that does not act on the material plane very often or very easily, but is capable of giving us advice and insights and that sort of thing.
Well, Mark, advice about what? Advice about investments? Advice about dating or diet plans? I mean, seriously, I respect what you're saying, but when you make this too personal, I think you trivialize what these others or other are. So I'm just asking, what sort of advice?
No, I'm not saying that necessarily advice. I'm not trying to make it personal or specific. I'm just saying that I've had proof in my life that there is a communication channel between us and some kind of intelligence that is outside the human mind. And
okay. No. Okay. We're on the completely the same wavelength there. I don't like using words like spiritual because I guess it just creeps me out. But I would give you a scientific analogy maybe is appropriate to bring in here that made a great impression on me, and that is the discovery of microbes. If you went back 200 years or more, you would find most people believing that major diseases, contagious diseases like diphtheria and so on, were caused by God or by sort of mists in the air. It was, in fact, very sort of spirit-like. If you had proposed at that time that no, there are little tiny, tiny creatures, invisible creatures, that have something to do with these diseases, you would have been thought to be crazy. But now we have it, this strange idea that that our lives can be so affected by teensy-tiny beings that we can't even see without, or we couldn't have seen without microscopes and other instruments.
Well, thank you for calling in, James. I've got a couple of emails I want to read. Ruby writes, Atheism, why take someone's belief and make going against it your label? There is no meaning of life. Life exists because of a physiological confluence of chemicals, hormones, enzymes, or whatever is the stuff of biology. But once here, isn't it smart to make the best of it? Don't we thrive when we help others achieve as we achieve? Doesn't it make the trip we're all on better if we accept we're in it together? Kindness, compassion helps all of us. It has nothing to do with a belief.
Yes, well, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But when you make your materialist statement that what's going on here is just like a lot of chemical processes and everything, I'd say, well, yes, but it's not just that, because those chemical processes are something we invented with our minds. We constructed with our intelligence and imagination and insight.
All right. Thank you, Ruby. And Kathleen says, Barbara, I identify with your relative, Mamie McLaughlin, in being betrayed by Catholic priests. My own whistleblowing in the financial markets and defiance and standing up for the underdog is due more to my Irish Cherokee background than any Catholic upbringing. The nuns and priests were usually incompetent, so it helped me to disrespect authority even more. I like a quote from a friend's mom who's Muslim, wherever people are kind, that's my temple. Nature is my temple personally.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
That's
you, Kathleen.
Nice.
That's
I
nice.
Like that.
And we've got time for a few more calls. Let's hear from Vicky in Santa Cruz. Hi, Vicky.
Hello, Rose. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Barbara. I just wanted to let you know that I believe when I was 14, I had a reverse deja vu, so to speak. I was reaching for my coat. It was a split second, and the thought went through my mind, my best friend was dead. And I'm like, well, why did I think that? Come on, let's go to the party. Okay, that was it. 3 months later, of course, after she died, another friend was honking for me to go to a movie, and it was the exact same moment. So it was like a reverse deja vu. I think a dent in life forces bring about spiritual experiences on so many different dimensions, and I truly believe that the life force has an impact on our consciousness.
Well, that's a way to put it, but what you're describing something I don't understand, and I don't think is understood at all, which is clairvoyance, the ability to see something that in the actual world that is going to happen or happened elsewhere. And I don't know what's up with that.
All right. Thank you for calling, Vicky. Let's hear from Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Very much enjoy both of you. This is a great show. Sorry. When I was a teenager, I taught myself to meditate. I didn't realize I was doing that. I would get confused, and I'd go upstairs in my closet, and I'd sit there in the dark and contemplate. And after doing this for a while, I had this vision that I entered this state where I was sort of in a in a container of space, is the best I can describe it. And I was, and then eventually I saw this vision of an albatross flying in front of me, and it was flying along before me, and I was, you know, sort of induced to go forward with this and to go through a portal and of some sort, and I
Ed, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have just a couple seconds left.
I got scared and I stopped and I didn't do it anymore. So
that's fascinating. I've never had a vision. I've never had a hallucination. So I can't really comment.
Well, thanks, Ed, and I'm really sorry to cut you off. Barbara, we've got about a minute left, but look, we've got full lines, and we have a bunch of emails that I didn't have time to read. So you wanted to spark a conversation by writing this book, and clearly people really want to talk about these issues.
Yeah, I guess I should think, you know, as I think it was Caitlin said, figure out, well, what do we do then?
Yeah, and then
how do we get together and not turn it into any kind of crazy cult?
So what are you planning to do next on this? Are you going to continue pursuing this and to bring up these
questions? I have a project. I don't know if it'll turn out into a book or whatever, but it's pulling me back in the direction of biology. And that question of, are we just chemicals? What does that mean? What's going on?
So that's the next pressing question.
Yeah.
And then what about your social justice work?
I work on, as you know, Ro, because
yes.
You've written for it,
yes.
A project called the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which attempts to raise money to support cutting-edge journalism, such as that of Rose Aguilar, and get it out into the media. See, right now nobody will pay you
right.
to do this writing.
To write about
photojournalism.
Poverty.
Yeah.
Usually.
Right.
And you're near the end of your tour, and are you going to continue talking about these issues?
I think I'll take a little while and maybe catch up on Game of Thrones.
Barbara Ehrenreich is author of the new book, Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. And you can find reviews and excerpts of her book at yourcallradio.org. Barbara, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure, Rose.
Great to see you. And thank you so much for all of your emails and phone calls. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation with Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl, directors of Citizen Coke, a documentary about money, power, and democracy. The film looks at how Citizens United drastically changed how the country's elections are fought and paid for. The filmmakers financed the film through Kickstarter after the independent television service withdrew funding. So how are the Koch brothers influencing the media and politics? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.